Tonight we are two chapters from the end of our study through the text of the minor prophet Hosea. We are in chapter 13, and I invite your attention there. This chapter, as is the tenor, really, of the whole book of the prophet, has to do with Israel's forgetting God. But this particular chapter emphasizes that as a problem led to their demise as a nation of people. We often talk about the need to remember and not to forget, and how important it is for us to not forget our history, because we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes if we don't have some recollection of our former failures. This people had a rich history. Their history wasn't one that was boring and mundane. It was rich. It was the kind of story or the kind of history account that you could just tell over and over because of the hand of God in all of it. And they had so much to look backwards on that should have provided motivation for a future that was solidly dependent upon God. But that didn't happen. They forgot the one true God and allowed the influences around them to turn their minds to things material, things vain, things empty, and in particular the idolatry of the land. They failed to acknowledge their history and their recollection of God, and so they had many problems about which we have read many in this particular book. In chapter 12, there are four designations that Hosea uses to communicate the message that he's trying to get across at this particular point. In verse 1, he speaks of Ephraim. And then verses 2 through 5, he speaks of Jacob, an ancestor in their immediate past that they no doubt would hear and pay attention to and understand the message communicated about that particular individual in their lives. So we'll talk about that in verses 2 through 5. In verses 6 through 9, the Canaanite is the designation or the term that he uses to emphasize a particular point or a lesson, and we'll note that when we get there. And then verses 10 through 14, the prophet. He comes back to the prophet and the prophet's mission and how they had failed the prophet. The prophet had failed them. That will be the course of our study tonight as we examine this chapter. So look at verse 1 with me. Ephraim, and remember, this designation is a tribe among the northern tribes, but one of the larger, and that designation is often used to represent the whole of the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes in the north. Ephraim feeds on the wind and pursues the east wind. He daily increases lies and desolation. Also, they make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried to Egypt. All right, so what's the point here? Well, you have this designation, Ephraim, indicating one who pursues vanity, a person who pursues things that are vain, pointless, and helpless. You know, you might be associated with people in this life, in your daily dealings, who has an interest in or pursues things that amount to nothing. We all might do that from time to time. I guess we all have to be careful about that. But someone focused on things that are of no profit. They major in things that aren't helpful and don't advance a cause worth advancing. And that's the condition of Ephraim. They're caught up in idolatry, caught up in worldliness, lost their spiritual focus. And so their activities, they're busy people, and they're a worshiping people. But it's all for naught. It's vanity. It's empty. And he uses that kind of language. They feed on the wind. Something empty. The Bible talks about grasping at the wind. If you think back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 26, Paul talks about running the race. He says, I run not with uncertainty. I fight not as one who beats the air. Okay, in Christianity, we're not shadow boxing. We're not beating or fighting the air. There's purpose and intent to what we're doing. And here, it ought to be the case with this nation of people that they're pursuing godliness and their substance to their worship and their service to God, but not so. They're like the one who feeds on the wind, feeds on vanity, and pursues vain things. Another aspect of what he says here, they daily increase lies and desolation, and they make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried to Egypt. As if it weren't bad enough that they were practicing idolatry and not responding to the God of heaven, they're stepping it up one. They're adding insult to injury. How? Well, they're trying to make covenant with the people who had them in bondage, Egypt, and the people who are about to take them into bondage. And they're rather than trusting God, they're trying to make a covenant deal with these other nations to protect them. And I suppose that might work when you're dealing on a purely human, man-to-man level. But when God is in the formula and you're trying to make a covenant with men to prevent God from doing something he intends to do, well, that's vanity. And not only just vanity, but it is adding insult to injury. It's just aggravating the situation even more. And so you have the odd consequences here of rejecting God. You can do what God says and receive his blessing, or you can reject what God says and receive a curse. And then you can step it up one by trying to make alliances as if they're going to protect you from God's judgment. And so in all regards, Ephraim is a pursuer of vanity. There's nothing that they're doing. There's no energy or effort that they are expending that amounts to anything worthwhile. Now when you get to verses 2 through 5, he brings up Jacob. And we might label these verses Jacob an inspiring history. Read along with me. The Lord also brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. Now notice Judah would be representative of the southern kingdom, the tribes in the south. They have been not in the scope of God's judgment, but they're in the target range because they're on the heels of the northern kingdom. They're flirting with the same things that have doomed Israel to captivity and judgment. And it's only going to be a matter of years before they follow their sister nation into captivity. But the prophet has kept them on alert. And it's reminded them, God's not missing what you're doing. He's giving you, in his long suffering, opportunity to get your act together. And so Judah's mentioned here, but now notice also in verse 2, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. Well, who is Jacob? Well, Jacob is the father of all these people. So now we have a designation that's an umbrella for all of them, for Israel and for Judah. And so Judah is drawing in both and Israel under the designation of Jacob, their father. Now, what's the point in bringing him in? Well, let's notice the rest of these verses. The Lord also brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and in his strength he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. That is the Lord God of hosts, the Lord. And your translation may say Jehovah there. The Lord is his memorable name, or memorial name in some translations. Let's notice a few things about these verses. First, as we already indicated, we're using a designation now that represents an inspiring history. And the prophet brings out some of those events. He talks about how Jacob had grabbed the heel of his brother at birth and tried to supplant the birth order, or to seize that blessing. And that was seen throughout his life as he tried to maneuver and get that blessing from God. You cannot say that Jacob was not interested in the blessing of God. At Bethel, the encounter with God, where he wrestled and would not relent until he received a blessing from God on that occasion. He was persistent. And that's their relative. That's their forefather. And it's an inspiring history about devotion and dedication and interest and pursuit of the blessing of God. Jacob was unrelenting in his struggle to be close with God. What a stark contrast in just a generation of people who seemingly have no interest in struggling to grasp the blessing that God has promised to bestow upon them. Reflect on your history, Israel. Verse 4, Bethel is a place that represented an intimate encounter with God. But at the time Hosea is writing, what is it? You remember, Jeroboam, the king of the northern tribes, set up two golden calves, one at Dan and one at Bethel. A place that represented a closeness and a close relationship with God, and the encounter of their forefather was now a place where they communed with idols who were vain and empty, and certainly not the God they had known and the God they had experienced in their knowledge. And it's as if the prophet has to remind them even of what his name is. And I'm horrible with names. I even try to make a point and remind myself. I'm bad about introducing myself and forgetting to, okay, don't forget the name. And you get caught up in the introduction part and forget the name. It's easy to forget people's names. But how do you forget God's name? How? The Lord God of hosts, Jehovah, is his memorable name. It's not a name easy to forget, and especially when it's connected with blessings, with acts, and mighty acts on the part of God that certainly could not be forgotten. So Ephraim, the pursuer of vanity in verse 1, verses 2 through 5, Jacob, reminding of an inspiring history that should have motivated them and moved them to faithfulness. It might do us well to ask ourselves if we have forgotten God's memorable name, to make sure that we do not forget God and the many blessings that he has bestowed upon us as his children. In verses 6 through 9, the designation that stands out and is significant here is the Canaanite. Look at the verses with me. So you, by the help of your God, return. Observe mercy and justice and wait on your God continually. A cunning Canaanite. Deceitful scales are in his hands. He loves to oppress. And Ephraim said, surely I have become rich. I have found wealth for myself in all my labors. They shall find in me no iniquity that is sin. But I am the Lord your God. Ever since the land of Egypt, I will again make you dwell in tents, as in the day of the appointed feast. Israel, Jacob, all noteworthy designations that speak of an inspiring history. But what's going on when God's people are referred to as the Canaanite? One who's dishonest, one who has two weights for his scales, one for his profit in one occasion when he's selling, and one for when he's buying. He's deceitful, he's dishonest. And now God says, you're like the Canaanite. Israel should have learned a relationship of dependence upon God, but they have learned to become more and more like the people around them. And now God, through the prophet, characterizes them as if they are just like the people that they were supposed to dispossess from the land. If God calls a people out from among others, and he says, be separate and don't touch the unclean thing. You're a special people. You're a chosen people. Deuteronomy this morning, you're different in all of these ways. The last thing that should happen is the designation is given to you that suggests you're no different than the people you're supposed to be separate from. There have been and continue to be tremendous lessons, I think, in this book that we ought to at least make a cursory application of to our own day. No, we're not the Israelite people dwelling in a physical land that God has blessed us with. No, we're not a generation from Jacob. No, we're not a people that are trying to make alliances with Egypt and Assyria. But spiritually and practically, there are so many things about this that resemble our duty and responsibility today. Have we been called out from among a people that we're supposed to be separate from? Sure we have. We are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people as the church. And we're supposed to be different. And yet, so many times, the church is engulfed in worldliness, materialism, and vanity. And it is as if God could say, at times, I'm having a hard time distinguishing between you and the world. We can't afford to let that happen to us as the church. We have to be distinctive. There must be something different about us that draws people to God. Not for us to be drawn into the world and to look just like them to the point where God says, you're just like the Canaanites. Notice something here in verse 8. Ephraim said, surely I have become rich. I have found wealth for myself in all my labors. Here's a people that looks at the fact that they're prospering. Yeah, I hear the prophet. I know what the prophet is saying. I hear the preacher. And I know he's saying, you better get your life right. But my life's actually going pretty well. We're doing good. We're rich. We're attaining wealth for ourselves. And then there's the mentality. The end justifies the means. I am where I want to be, so the way that I got here must be the right way and an okay way. Don't get caught up in that kind of thinking, because that's exactly what they are saying. I hear you. I hear that about the captivity, but we're doing just fine, and we're rich, and we're wealthy, and we've made ourselves this way. And God says, I'm going to put you back in tents. You came from tents. You dwelt in temporary shelters in the wilderness. I brought you to this fine and large and land that is flowing with milk and honey, and you built houses for yourself. But you made a mistake. You made the mistake of saying, I have done this. And you didn't. God did it. And you've forgotten Him. And you've lost sight of the source of your blessings. And not only that, you've carved a piece of wood and you set it up on a platform and you've said, this is the God who blessed me so that I could do all of these things for myself. And God says, I'm going to put you back in tents. Can we learn anything from that tonight? About our prosperity and our successes and how we're permitted by God to thrive in the way that we do and what we ought to do in return with the manifold blessings that He's bestowed upon us. We talk about self included. What a privileged situation we are in the nation that we live in, where we have the freedom and liberty to worship as often as we want to. And the tendency is always there, brothers and sisters, to lose sight of what a privilege that is. Until somebody takes it away from us. And then we'd be fighting tooth and nail to recover it. Just like these people. They're going to go into captivity. And they'll fight and they'll complain. And they'll think it's not fair. But the whole time God had given them liberty and freedom to exercise themselves and to use their free moral choice to serve and worship Him, they wouldn't do it. And it's only when it's taken from you, seemingly, it's only when it's taken from us that we really stop to think about what a privilege and blessing we have. We're the church. And God has blessed us immeasurably. And it ought not take putting us in desperate situations such as back in tents to get us to realize how fortunate we are. These people are a lesson for us to not let worldliness invade our lives and to not allow ourselves to ever get to the point of thinking, I am what I am because of what I have done. If that's the approach that we take, then we're standing here burdened and laden with our sins and nothing to do with them. We're a blessed people, and we need to be different. In verses 10 through 14, he returns to the prophet, through the prophet. Read the verses with me. I have also spoken by the prophets and have multiplied visions. I have given symbols through the witness of the prophets through Gilead. Though Gilead has idols, surely their vanity. Though they sacrifice bulls in Gilgal, indeed their altars shall be heaps in the furrows of the field. Jacob fled to the country of Syria. Israel served for a spouse and for a wife he tended sheep. By a prophet, the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt. See how far back the prophet's involvement goes in leading these people to where God was taking them? By a prophet, the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet he is preserved. Ephraim provoked him to anger most bitterly. Therefore, his Lord will leave the guilt of his bloodshed upon him and return his reproach upon him. Here we have the prophet as an unheeded alarmist. The prophet sounds the alarm, but they're not listening. They're not heeding what the prophet says. The prophets were ignored, and the message of warning was not even considered. You know, people sometimes find, even Christians sometimes find it hard to stomach the true God and the things that he says for their life. And so they make their own God. Or they go searching for another way to be religious or to be spiritual rather than sitting down and listening to what the God of heaven, the only one that matters, has to say. But if it's not God that we're listening to, it's vanity. It may be the most pious religious situation that makes me feel great, but if it's not God, it's vanity. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 9, "In vain they worship me, teaching for doctrine the commandments of men." We have to listen to the prophet. We don't have prophets as such today, but we have the Word of God. We have preachers who proclaim the message, and we have elders who shepherd us according to that message, and we need to listen to it. Look at this interesting thought in these verses. Their altars, verse 11, their altars shall be heaps in the furrows of the field. Think back in time, maybe you had a nice 65 Mustang, and you just loved that car. You had all these memories of that car. I had a truck. It was a 65 Chevrolet truck, and I had all these memories of that vehicle and how much I enjoyed it. I don't know where it is now. I have a mind. I've looked for it. I've tried to find it. But I have a mind. It's sitting out in the middle of a field somewhere, rusting. The weeds, thorns, and thickets growing up all around it where you can't get to it. You couldn't move it if you wanted to. And it's just sitting there. And now, whoever's mowing that field has to mow around it. It's just an object, the vanity out in the middle of the field. You have to mow around it. And that's what the prophet is saying about their idols and their altars. They're just furrows in the field. Whoever's mowing has to mow around them now. It's a place where they had all of these memories of these gods that did so many great things for them. They did nothing for them. And the fact that it's a chunk of rock in the middle of a field with all the thorns growing up around it, vanity, proves and demonstrates that those things are why they are headed into captivity. The prophet tried to hold their hand up in the past, tried to lead them and guide them in the way, but they didn't listen. And God says, no more. It's too late to listen. And we know from looking at this side of it that this nation goes into captivity and they just basically disappear. And all of that because they forgot the memorable name of their God. The recollection of God's favor in our past ought to be inspiration for our future. You know, you think about this congregation and the history of it, dating back at least 50 years, the time of the erection of this building. And the people who were instrumental in that, involved in it, had no idea what would become of the Church of Christ in Roanoke. Rural farm community. It would always be that, right? But it's not today. It's a growing, developing, thriving community that seemingly is only going to get bigger. And look at the transitions that this congregation has made. with good, strong families, with men who serve as elders and lead us, people who are interested in truth. That history ought to always be a motivator for us going forward, to remember how God has blessed us. That God, not the one in our wallet, or all of the things that we own and possess, but that God has allowed and permitted us to get to where we are today. And I have a mind that He will continue to bless us. I'm not trying to be funny or anything. It stands to reason, let me say it that way, that as long as we continue to do what He's told us to do, He will continue to bless us. But we can't forget Him. We can't become like the people around us that we're supposed to be separate from. And we can't pursue things that are vain. We must pursue things that are associated with and representative of thus saith the Lord. How memorable is God's name to us in the church, in our homes, in our individual lives? Don't forget who's in charge of everything and who is the dispenser of the blessings and favor on those who do His will, and the dispenser of the curses on those who do not. It's tragic when God's people begin to epitomize sin instead of being a contrast to it. May God help us never to do that. May He help us to learn from the mistakes of those who have gone before us. That's why it's here. And let us learn the lessons and do better, and make sure our focus is always where it ought to be. Those are the kinds of lessons we ought to learn when we study these minor prophets. And I hope that this is helping all of us in some way. Tonight, as we bring this service to a close, we don't want to do that without extending the Lord's invitation. There may be one who needs to obey the gospel tonight. Maybe a child of God who's wayward and needs to rededicate their life to Him. We're going to sing a song to encourage. And if you have such a need, we hope you'll come as we stand and sing.